It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk about combating depression in the new year and what resources are out there to help.
First, today is Inauguration Day in Wisconsin, and this morning, Governor Scott Walker was sworn in for his second term at the Capitol in Madison.
In his inauguration speech, Governor Walker stressed things like small government and a balanced budget and contrasted the state with Washington, D.C. Here's a clip from his speech. He's referencing the state constitution.
Unlike other places around the world, this document says that in Wisconsin, it doesn't matter what class you were born into or what your parents did for a living. Here, our opportunities should be as equal as possible, as equal as possible. But the outcomes, well, those outcomes should still be up to each and every one of us. In Wisconsin, we understand that true freedom and prosperity do not come from the mighty hand of the government. They come from empowering people to control their own lives and their own destinies through the dignity that is born from work.
It's the beginning of the governor's second term, and politicos are watching him closely in his expected run-up to a presidential campaign. Here with us to talk about his inauguration today and what we can expect from Governor Walker in the coming months, maybe that presidential run, is Mike Wagner. He's an assistant professor of journalism at UW-Madison. Mike, welcome back.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Well, what struck you most today about the governor's speech?
I would say what struck me most is his assiduous avoidance of making news. It was a very vanilla speech. There wasn't much in the way of specifics. There wasn't a lot of pivoting to issues that have an automatic, you know, that wouldn't cause an automatic spidey sense to go up to say, oh, he's talking about this because he's running for president. There wasn't a lot of that, I don't think, in the speech. And it was a garden variety inaugural address.
So what do you make of that? If you're looking at a guy who's considering a presidential bid, what does that tell you?
Well, one thing Governor Walker said in his speech was that he and his wife had decided years ago, he said in the speech, that he wanted to run for governor, or that they wanted to run for governor. And so that struck me as him communicating that he's a planner. And so that makes me think Governor Walker knows what it is that he wants to do. He's just not ready to reveal what that is. But if you were someone who wasn't going to run, there's nothing to lose by saying so. And so it seems to me that it's more likely than not that he might be interested in it. But of course, that'll be on his timetable. And it'll probably also depend upon how other top tier candidates like Jeb Bush and Chris Christie fare over the next few months.
Typically, what does a politician want to accomplish with their inauguration speech? And where does the governor's speech fit into that?
In an inauguration speech, especially after an election, executives like governors want to say, here's why I won. And because that's why I won, here are the things I want to do in office. And so he talked a lot about issues that are near and dear to his heart, including issues related to children. He talked a bit about the military. He talked about education, retirement, the state of the economy, taxes, and all of it kind of went back to his kind of most important public core value, which is individual freedom. And so he talked a lot about issues where individuals would maximize their freedom away from the government. And the other thing that he talked a lot about in his speech was how awful the government is and how it's his job and others' jobs to make sure the government doesn't try to do too much.
And religion had a prominent role in the inauguration proceedings today. Lieutenant Governor Clayfish's daughters led a prayer. There were lots of religious references. Tonette and the governor, his wife, referenced how they prayed in the lead-up to his bid for governor. What do you think about how that role of religion played and what it says about who he is?
Well, I think that that's something that we've seen more and more of in American politics, especially from those in the Republican Party, where a large core base of their constituency are people who are both kind of theologically and politically conservative. And so it's not surprising to see Governor Walker begin his speech more or less at the beginning by thanking God. It's something he regularly does in his speech. It's not something that he just trotted out for the inaugural. He does that regularly. And we saw, a lot of other kind of religious iconography and symbols and prayers from various members of both his family and the lieutenant governor's family. And it's certainly a part of who he is. And it's also a signal to the kinds of people who vote in presidential primaries, evangelical conservatives, that Governor Walker sees eye to eye with them on a whole host of important issues.
What role would you say religion has had so far in his first 4 years?
That's a good question. It's hard to say. I mean, the things that he's most known for, such as Act 10, don't have obvious religious overtones. But the way that he talks about other prominent social issues, especially abortion and especially kind of freedom of religion to operate in various elements of public life, including private schooling and homeschooling and things like that, he's certainly been an advocate of Christian religion as understood by those who are more theologically conservative.
Now, one thing we did not hear in the speech today, you said news. Another was any sort of conciliatory language directed at Democrats, maybe saying, oh, it's been a rough road, but we're going to work together, get stuff done. You didn't hear that. Does that mean anything? Or is that, again, just sort of typical about what you might hear at an inauguration speech?
You usually hear, I'm going to reach across party lines and we're going to work together to get things done. And so it was a little surprising maybe that there wasn't a lot of language that was based on kind of putting the acrimony of the past behind them. It seemed as though the governor wanted to spend more time comparing Wisconsin politics to Washington, D.C., and talked a lot about how politics in Washington or along the banks of the Potomac, as he put it, don't know how to get things done, whereas we do here in Wisconsin and we do things differently. And so you could read that as a more inclusive tone that's not just talking about Republicans, but there wasn't a let's work with Democrats and get things done kind of section of the speech that some people might have expected.
Right. Let's listen a bit to the section that you're talking about, where Governor Walker is talking about the contrast that he sees between Wisconsin and Washington.
There is a clear contrast between Washington and Wisconsin. We have been good stewards of the taxpayers' money and lowered their tax burden as well. We've shown why the founders of this great nation looked to the states and not the federal government as the source of hope for this exceptional country. We will not let them down.
Now, if you're looking for the seeds of a presidential bid, it seems to me that that's it, because he's highlighting his record getting stuff done, as he says, here in Wisconsin, moving stuff forward. Well, the federal government has been seen as being stuck in a rut and not being able to move things due to dysfunction.
And that's the classic governor's pitch if they want to run for president. That's Bill Clinton in 1992. I was, in charge of Arkansas and we saw our test scores go up and our health care get better. Or George W. Bush as governor of Texas doing the exact same thing. We lowered taxes and we got more people educated and we improved relations across the border. Those kinds of things are things that governors regularly tout when they're running for president. And the way that they do that is they say politics is awful. Washington politics is especially awful. I'm not a part of that, and so elect me to fix it. And in some respect, Barack Obama ran on that same kind of platform, even though he was in Washington politics as a senator, but he ran on kind of a change the way we do things kind of outsider election strategy in some ways. And that's, something we heard from Governor Walker today, too.
Do you think that is an especially strong pitch, particularly if everybody uses it and voters are used to hearing it?
Well, people don't like politics, and that doesn't change. And people are pretty upset at the lack of progress that Congress in particular has made in Washington, D.C. When the Democrats were in charge in the early part of the Obama administration and when the Republicans were in charge more recently. And so it's a bipartisan distaste for politics. And when someone says they know how to get things done and move past the acrimony, that message is one that people, at least some people, cling to because they would like it if some of the acrimony disappeared. It's difficult to do that when Republicans and Democrats disagree with each other on 90% of the issues that are out there.
We're talking with Mike Wagner right now, assistant professor of journalism at UW-Madison, about Scott Walker's Inauguration Day speech, which happened today, and his possible plans for a potential bid for president.
And we want to hear from you. Call in with your questions, your comments about Governor Walker's presidential potential at 800-642-1234. Do you think he could get the Republican nomination? If not, who has a better shot? What would he have to do to shore up his credentials? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation now with Mike Wagner, assistant professor of journalism at UW-Madison. We're talking about Governor Scott Walker's re-inauguration day speech and the potential for a run for president.
And if you have questions or comments about the governor's presidential ambitions, what you heard in that speech today, give us a call at 800-642-1234. What do you see as Governor Walker's strengths or maybe potential challenges for getting the Republican nomination? 800-642-1234, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, one of the key moments in the speech came today when the governor talked about school choice programs, and also he talked about smaller government and a balanced budget. We've got a little clip here. Let's listen.
We will reduce the size and scope of government to match the will of the people. State agencies will be merged to make them more effective, more efficient, and more accountable to the public. We will continue to weed out waste, fraud, and abuse. Budgets will be set based on the taxpayer's ability to pay and not on the government's ability to spend.
And what do you hear in that clip, Mike?
I hear traditional Republican notes of balanced budgets, of reining in spending, of government waste, of the government tries to do too much and the government should back off and let individuals have more of a say in how their lives go. And that those are traditional part and parcel policy positions we hear from the Republican Party.
Was this speech at all disappointing for those who are watching so closely to see whether he's going to commit to a run for president? Was there maybe the hope that there would be some fireworks here?
Well, I think people who are more interested in presidential politics might have liked to have seen a bit more of hints that he was thinking one way or the other. But, you know, he's not giving the speech to presidential election watchers. You know, he's giving the speech to our state. And if he is going to run for president, he's, you know, giving it with in the back of his mind, you know, the idea of people who might be donors and early endorsers, you know, of him to hear the kinds of core values that he has. And so he didn't talk in specifics today. He just kind of talked in broad platitudes about things he believed in and things that he had done in his first term, but nothing concrete, nothing particularly newsworthy.
In terms of school choice programs, that was a keynote in the speech. Do you see that as being something at the top of the list as we go forward?
I think it is for him. Whether that's also at the top of the Assembly and State Senate's lists remain to be seen. And so it seems like whereas the first term of Governor Walker was characterized by fireworks between Republicans and Democrats, now that the legislature is more Republican and more conservative than it was before, we might see the legislature pressuring the governor to do some things such as right to work, which they've talked about a lot about and the governor has not been as excited about. And so we might see a little bit more tension within the party in term number two.
How does that balance of power play out? If the legislature says we want to go for this, we want right to work. The governor says this isn't what I want right now. I have other things on my agenda. Where does the scale tip?
Well, it depends on who's got more power and it depends upon how the base, the Republican Party base, breaks down in terms of whether they're more on the legislature side or more on the governor's side. And so, and it also depends upon the kinds of deals that might get made behind closed doors or in full public view about, well, if we're going to do this, then I also want you to take up this issue that I really care about. And so there's a lot of what political scientists call log rolling. So I scratch your back, you scratch mine in terms of getting policies passed.
We'll go to our phones now. We've got a call here from Marty in Milwaukee. Hi, Marty.
Hi. I just caught the end of the governor's speech and the comment on it. And I was just going to say, you know, he's, you know, again, hitting all the Republican points there. But really, I don't know that he would have much of a chance of winning in a general election. And as far as his points about the Wisconsin, you know, sort of the eliminating fraud, doing the people's business, knocking down taxes. Well, bulk of the fraud in Wisconsin at the moment is in his administration. As far as taxes go, people aren't necessarily opposed to paying taxes if they feel that they're getting a reasonable return on their money. You know, most people I know are more than willing to pay taxes if, in fact, their government is functioning correctly.
Marty, let me jump in here. Why do you think he doesn't have a chance of winning the general election?
Well, I just don't think that given the given the mood of the country, that they would be willing to take a Republican, no matter who it was, and especially I think Scott Walker and Christie both have a tremendous amount of baggage that they're not going to be able to drag through a general election without getting shot down.
Okay, well, thanks for your thoughts, Marty. Appreciate that. Marty's saying he's got too much baggage when we saw the fireworks of Act 10. Is that a liability, though, or is that a plus? This is a guy who did something pretty controversial, and he survived the recall.
Yeah, and in terms of the legislative baggage, that'll be a badge of honor in a Republican primary to say I took on the labor unions and won. In a general election, it becomes a little bit harder to defend when you're trying to appeal to moderate voters, but a presidential election is not going to be about Act 10. On the legislative side, he doesn't have, I don't think, much to worry about in terms of legislative baggage per se. Presidential elections typically are more about the future and the state of the economy. And if the economy is strong, any Republican is going to have a really hard time. And if we keep up with 5% growth, that'll be very good for the Democrats. On the other hand, I think the caller is also referring to, the John Doe investigation and things of that nature. And on the one hand, those kinds of scandals can be really problematic for somebody seeking the White House. On the other hand, there's a long history of politicians getting past scandals and getting elected president. We saw Bill Clinton being accused of being a draft dodger, being accused of being a serial philanderer, a murderer, and other kinds of things as when he ran for president and, won and cruised a reelection. And so it's not like a little bit of baggage can or scandal in the past can keep someone from winning the White House.
What would you say his priorities are right now or should be if Scott Walker wants to present himself as the best candidate for the Republican nomination?
He needs to appeal to the kinds of people who make early endorsements and give money to presidential candidates. And so he needs to make sure that the party insiders want him to win. It is incredibly difficult for a Republican or a Democrat to get elected or to win their party's nomination unless the party insiders, members of state governments around the country, party chair people, those and the money people in the party, if those folks don't want you, no amount of popular appeal is going to help. And we've seen that happen in both parties in recent elections. We saw Howard Dean take off popularly in 2004. The party insiders were not with him, and he flamed out spectacularly. And we've seen the same sort of thing on the Republican side, too, where you had seven or eight people in first place in the Republican primary in the last go-round, but Mitt Romney was the one the insiders wanted, and that's the one that they got. And so Governor Walker needs to appeal to party insiders around the country. If you see him giving speeches in Iowa and New Hampshire and South Carolina and Florida and giving them to the state Republican Party, you'll know that he's taking that seriously.
Is it time to establish a message and hone it and start getting it out there? Or right now, does he want to just sort of keep his nose down and be slow and steady?
Well, I think, he wants to frame what he's about. And today's speech, I think, did a reasonable job of doing that. He's about individual freedom. He's about faith. He's about respect for the police and the military. He cares about school choice, those sorts of things. And so he talked about all of that stuff broadly in today's speech. And it seems that if he ran for president, he would run against the government and for individual freedom. And most issues would fall into one of those two kinds of categories, I think.
So the fact that you said he was careful not to make news with this speech, you think that's consistent with a candidate who is seriously eyeing a run?
Right. If you're not going to run, why not have wild applause and say you'll be seeing me in this chamber, every January for the next 4 years?
So do you expect that to be the tone going forward?
What to be the tone?
That he will not be looking for what you just said.
You see him asking, or kind of signaling to his fellow partisans that he doesn't want to deal with right to work, which is a controversial issue related to labor unions. He looks to be trying to keep those kinds of things out of the headlines so that he can make some gains in areas that he might want to tout if he does decide to run. But he also could be doing that because that's what he wants to do as governor. We won't know until he tells us.
It's still considered early, right?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. When do we start looking at our watches and go, okay, he's got to start announcing yes or no?
If I think by mid-spring there's not an exploratory committee formed, or if he's not significantly hedging when people are asking him, then maybe the pendulum starts to swing in the other direction.
Are you willing to place a bet at this point, just based on what you're seeing?
If I'm betting with your money, I would bet that he was going to run.
Okay. And what would that bid look like? What do you think about Scott Walker, the candidate? Assuming that you're right, your bet is well placed, and he does run, what do you think a Scott Walker candidacy looks like?
Well, I don't think he'll start as a top-tier candidate. Jeb Bush and Chris Christie, I think, are the most... the people have the best chance to win of those who might be running right now. But Governor Walker will be able to say, I have won 3 elections in 4 years in a state that the Democrats have carried in the last several presidential elections. You guys have to win Wisconsin if you want to win. I've won it 3 times. I'm the kind of person who can win polarized states. That to me would be a message he would want to give to these donors and activists who vote in primaries.
And you said he's got to appeal to the party insiders right now and the donors. Do
right.
you see him doing that? Is he well positioned to do just that?
He's given a few speeches around the country and wrote a book. He's done those sorts of things. He didn't do a lot of it during the gubernatorial campaign for obvious reasons. And so I think if in 2 or 3 months we don't see him doing at least a little bit of that, then it's worthwhile to ask more questions about whether he really wants to run.
A lot to keep our eyes on. Well, Mike, thank you so much for stopping by.
My pleasure.
We've been speaking with Mike Wagner, assistant professor of journalism at UW-Madison, about Scott Walker's Inauguration Day speech and his possible plans for a presidential run. You can continue that conversation with your thoughts over on the Central Time Facebook page. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Late last year, the Centers for Disease Control released a report that provided a snapshot of depression in the United States. It found that about 1 in 13 Americans is suffering from depression, about 8% of the population.
The report also found that the majority of depression sufferers aren't getting treatment, and that's causing concern among mental health professionals. So what are some of the roadblocks to seeking treatment? And as we start a new year, is now the right time to reach out for help, either for yourself or for a loved one?
Joining us now to help answer these questions, we have Annabelle Potvin. She's the advocacy org coordinator at the National Alliance on Mental Illness, Wisconsin. Annabelle, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we've made it through the holidays. We're into 2015, New Year's resolution time. Is that a time when a lot of people start to think about their situation, maybe start to seek help for depression or other mental health issues?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say that, any time you're noticing emotions or behaviors that have been bothering you for a long time, it's time to seek support, whether or not that's the beginning of the year or not. But if making a New Year's resolution along with it helps you feel motivated and excited about making a change, then that's great. But I could also see that approach, not being right for everyone. If your efforts don't pan out in a linear way and sometimes experiences with mental health issues do not, then that might just add another layer of frustration that you might not need to be dealing with. So I guess it kind of just depends on the person's, personal feelings about New Year's resolutions.
Mm-hmm. Now, from what I understand about depression, especially severe depression, is the condition itself can restrict people's abilities to take action. How do we get people to overcome the depression enough to seek help for the depression?
Yeah, that's a really, really good point. I think for a lot of people, the key is really just to take it slow and to reach out for help. There are a lot of organizations, NAMI Wisconsin included, that can help people kind of navigate the mental health system because, as you said, it can be really overwhelming, and that in itself, just making that call can really stop people from getting the help that they need. So I would really encourage people to reach out for help with that initial step because sometimes it's that first step that stops people.
And I imagine it's hard to figure out the signs, see the symptoms in ourselves. How do we distinguish between maybe a short-lived low point or a seasonal depression and the kind of clinical depression that might require some serious help?
Yeah, you really want to be on the lookout for really the key symptoms of depression. And that's major loss of energy, lack of interest in your normal activities, low self-esteem, strong feelings of hopelessness, all of those things. And if you do identify some of those experiences, then the main question to ask is how long has this been going on? So, if you felt those things for a few days or a week, then it's probably okay to give it some time and just see how you feel. But if you're feeling like that for weeks or months, then it's definitely time to take action. Overall, I would really urge people to just be proactive about getting help. so if you spent the last few months thinking, I might be depressed and maybe I should get help, then you probably should. I think we tend to, you know, impose these artificial standards of, am I sick enough or depressed enough? And we tend to assume that we can solve it alone. But the truth is that if you're feeling sad all the time, you're losing interest in life, you're feeling hopeless, it's best to just reach out. If only to learn about what's available rather than just, you know, relying on your own assumptions about what mental health treatment looks like. So even if it doesn't turn out that you are diagnosed with depression, you know, there's nothing to lose from just reaching out.
We'll get into what's out there, what kind of help people can reach out to in just a few moments. But I wanted to dig a little bit into that report from the CDC. 1 in 13 Americans, they say, suffering from depression at some point in a 3-year span, 8% of Americans. Does that surprise you? Is that more prevalent than you would have thought?
Well, my understanding is that the number has really hovered between that 5 and 8% range for some time. You know, so it's disheartening that it's not lower. And, you know, it's also important to remember that those numbers are self-reported. So people who aren't maybe willing to disclose that they're dealing with depression or even admit it to themselves might not be captured in that data. So the percentage might, you know, even be higher in reality. So it's really disheartening.
Well, one lesson there maybe for someone suffering from depression is this is a lot of people. You're not alone.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, and even when you think about mental illnesses overall, it's 25% is the estimate right now. 1 in 4 people nationwide experience some kind of mental health condition in any given year. So you're absolutely right. You're not alone.
And back to that CDC report, the majority of people dealing with depression, not seeking help, not getting help from a mental health professional, only 35% of people with severe depression, 20% with moderate depression said they'd sought help. Alarming, I think, to mental health professionals. Why do you think so few are seeking help and getting connected with help?
You know, I would say that the stigma of mental illness is still a huge reason. You know, our society still has so many negative stereotypes about people who seek help, and we internalize those stereotypes, and so we avoid being part of that group because, you know, we don't want to be lumped in with a group of people that society sees in a negative light. And I also think we see help-seeking behavior itself in a negative way. You know, culturally, we tend to be very individualistic, very, you know, really value self-reliance and independence. And so asking others for help with personal issues can be really hard for a lot of us. Even though most of us would say that we wouldn't judge other people for seeking help, we're really quick to judge ourselves. So I think that that public stigma and then that self-stigma is still really powerful.
So we see mental illness or seeking help for it as a sign of weakness in ourselves.
Yeah, I think that does unfortunately tend to be the case when, in fact, of course, it's a very brave and admirable and responsible thing to do. But that does seem to be the cultural context that we see it in.
And there's been an effort from groups like yours to change this conversation, to see seeking help as a sign of strength for at least a few years now. Are you starting to see that change? Are we starting to turn away from this this view of mental illness as a stigma?
You know, I think we are talking. You know, we're talking more about stigma, we're talking more about mental health, and then that's a really good thing. And, you know, we're starting to see it coming up in political conversations much more, we're starting to see it on social media, and we're talking about stigma and mental health in kind of an abstract way, but sometimes I think we don't talk about kind of the real-life impacts of stigma as much as we should, and by that I mean, I guess, the discrimination that people with mental illness face. So whether that's in, you know, employment or housing or healthcare, people are having really real effects of stigma in their daily lives, and I think that the conversation still really needs to go in that direction. But yeah, I do think we're making big strides in talking about mental health generally.
So stigma, one roadblock, maybe keeping people from getting treatment. But how about, you know, paying for it, the cost issue and the availability of mental health providers?
Yes, absolutely. For a lot of people, accessing care they can afford is a huge challenge. You know, even with new options under the Affordable Care Act, a lot of people still have pretty sizable deductibles that make it hard to justify non-emergency services. So, you know, if you're on the fence about going to see a therapist and you're not sure exactly how it's going to help, you don't know a lot about therapy, but you do know that you'll have to pay out of pocket for the first few sessions, then you might just say, okay, well, never mind. You know, I'll put it off and wait for a different time when I can afford it. And then in terms of accessibility, people in the public mental health system are often facing really long wait lists before they can even access care at all. So overall, yes, lack of accessible and affordable services are a huge issue that prevent people from seeking care.
Well, let's talk first steps here. Suppose somebody out there is listening and saying, you know, this sounds kind of like me. I have those symptoms that you just described of depression. What do they do? What do they pick up the phone and do or go online and do to get started to see what's out there for them?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I would say the first step would be just to reach out to someone in your life to talk about what's going on and just to normalize that experience. And, you know, like we were talking about before, statistics show that about, you know, 8% of us are dealing with depression. And then in terms of all mental illnesses, about 25% of us are dealing with some type of challenge. So when you reach out, there's a really good chance that the person you reach out to might just have had a similar experience. And then in terms of accessing services, I think it's important to keep in mind that Wisconsin has a county-based mental health system. So if you have public insurance or you're uninsured, your county human services agency is probably the best place to start. And then if you have private insurance, you can simply call your plan and ask for a referral to a mental health professional. So those are some broad starting points, but ultimately, depending on the resources you have and your location, each person's options are going to be, you know, fairly unique. But to start that process, you can always, again, reach out to organizations like NAMI Wisconsin to help you understand where to start. I think that people who don't deal with mental health challenges tend to think that reaching out for help is a pretty simple process, and they don't understand why people hesitate or struggle. But really, you know, not even thinking about navigating the system and the bureaucracy, it can be really difficult just from an emotional perspective. You know, really stressful and difficult to make that first call. So as I said before, I would really encourage people to reach out to a support organization to help them start that process.
We're talking about depression in the United States with Annabelle Potvin of NAMI Wisconsin, and how to seek treatment for depression in the new year. And we want to hear from you, too.
If you've struggled with depression, did you seek help or not? And what resources worked the best for you? What advice would you give to someone who is struggling with depression? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Annabelle Potvin about seeking treatment for depression in this new year. A recent CDC survey finds that about 8% of Americans have dealt with depression over a three-year span, and that the majority of people dealing with depression aren't getting the help and treatment that they need. We're trying to get to the bottom of that. You can join in with your questions, your comments, and maybe your own experiences and advice at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to a caller. We've got Matt on the line in Menominee. Matt, hi.
Hi, guys. My big thing is that my wife kind of sometimes she says, you know, I think I'm depressed, and I don't know exactly what to say because in my mind, she's just kind of, this is going to sound terrible, okay, but, like, this is kind of an anonymous call, but I think she's kind of lazy. Like, she'll sleep really late on days that she has off. She doesn't really have hobbies or interests, and all those symptoms you're saying, like insecure about body image, things like that. But a lot of it is, I'm like, well, you just got to exercise, and we just got to go out and, you know, go play tennis or go run on the track or do something like this. Or you got to just start writing or doing something that you did, like, when you were in college. But she just doesn't really, you know, she just kind of doesn't want to do any of those things, you know. And I bring them up in a very nice way, but I just really don't know. She's not clinically depressed, you know, anything like that. She's not sad and hopeless feeling, but just kind of bums around a little bit more than I like, and I just don't know how to encourage that. And
Matt, thanks a lot for calling and sharing that story. I want to bring Annabelle Potvin in on this. Annabelle, he brings up a lot there. Let's start with, okay, someone close to you says they're depressed or is showing symptoms of it. How do you talk to them? How do you bring up these issues, pep talks, point them toward advice? What do we do?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm so glad that he brought up that issue because I think it's really, really hard from an outside perspective to understand what's going on with someone, especially with something like depression where, you know, a lot of people do have depression because they've had a traumatic experience or something really, really, you know, externally stressful is going on in their lives. But often it's kind of just happening to you. And then to other people, it might not seem like there's a good reason why it's happening. So it can be really frustrating for people on the outside to understand what's happening. But in terms of talking to the person, I mean, first of all, I think a huge, huge message I would give to that caller is just to listen and not to offer suggestions on how to fix it always. You know, sometimes people just need someone to listen and to empathize with what they're going through. But, you know, kind of the main ideas or main messages to keep in mind would just be, you know, depression isn't something that the person can snap out of. It isn't a sign of laziness or weakness, even though, you know, when someone is sleeping more often or not as active, not as interested, it can really look like those things, but it's just inherently not. And it also that it isn't something that's easy to fix. Those are just important messages to keep in mind from the family member or supporter perspective.
Good luck to you and your wife, Matt. Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Again, talking about depression in the United States, what help is out there? Maybe your experience in dealing with it, maybe overcoming it? 800-642-1234. We'll go back to the phones with Eric now in Oshkosh. Eric, hi.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to mention something that that my psychologist brought up to me, and it made the world a difference in my life, and that's the connection between adult ADD and depression, just the inability to concentrate and get tasks done were really what was at the root of my depression. And with methylphenidate to treat my ADD, I was able to go off antidepressants, and things are a lot better.
Eric, thanks a lot for that call. So depression co-occurring, I think that's the medical term, Annabelle, with ADD and beyond, maybe depression and substance abuse and other issues. How often do we see depression wrapped up with another issue?
Yeah, really often. And again, I'm glad that caller brought that up. For example, with substance use, I believe the statistic is about 53% of people with mental illness are also struggling with some kind of substance use issue. So it's really common. And a lot of illnesses can mirror each other in the beginning stages when they emerge. For example, bipolar disorder is often misdiagnosed as depression because someone might be going through a depressive phase and that's all that the clinician sees. But then a few months later, they cycle into mania and they don't want to go see the doctor during that time. So people are often misdiagnosed when there are co-occurring issues happening.
Thanks a lot for that call. And it occurred to me that was a caller who just frankly discussed his experience openly, honestly, no shame there. Is it important that we get people who are dealing with depression, who have been through it and come back out the other side to talk about their stories?
Absolutely, yes. So the best research on stigma shows that hearing stories of recovery directly from people with lived experience is really the best, most powerful way to reduce stigma. So it's that actual contact with someone who has had that lived experience that changes attitudes. Educating people on the different illnesses isn't as effective. You know, once we hear from someone who experiences depression or any type of mental illness, it kind of reduces our fear of the unfamiliar. When we can actually put a face and a voice to the issue, it becomes something that we can relate to and better understand. And not to mention, you know, sharing stories can really benefit the person who's sharing. For many people, there's a huge sense of empowerment and self-acceptance that comes with being open about, you know, such a significant life experience. And, of course, people share in different ways depending on what feels right to them. You know, some people become open with just a few family members or friends, and other people choose to publicly share their story as a form of advocacy. But however the person chooses to share, there's always a positive impact. And I appreciate, you know, the callers calling in and being open. That's really, really powerful.
I'll go to another caller now. We've got Cindy with us in De Pere. Cindy, hi.
Hi. I missed part of the last call because I was calling in, but I was responding to Matt's call. Just coming from the other side, when a person says that, you know, you should get up and you should go do this or do that or go exercise, you know, it just seems like you're being lazy or all of this. I know that it's hard for them to understand, but part of the whole depression makes you feel, it's physical. You don't feel like you could possibly do it. And then what happens is that the person who is depressed alienates themselves from their relationships because they feel like they're a burden and they feel like they're bringing them down. So they have even less of contact or help or a place to go.
Cindy, thanks a lot for sharing that. So the importance of keeping social connections open and maybe avoiding the kind of judgment that Cindy was talking about, Annabelle.
Yeah, absolutely. And like she said, it can kind of be that vicious cycle. You know, if you're not feeling good, you're not feeling like yourself, then you kind of just want to isolate. But as we know, that's the last thing you want to do when you're feeling depressed in terms of, you know, making the illness have a better course. So it really is a vicious cycle in that way. And so it's so important for family members and friends to be respectful and non-judgmental in the way that they interact with you. Something from that family member and supporter perspective I would really suggest is to reach out to our organization, NAMI. We have support groups and educational programs for family members and supporters to kind of better understand what the person is going through and just kind of gain some strategies on how to better communicate with them and better support them.
Well, that's a great place to leave it. Annabelle, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me and for covering this topic.
That was Annabelle Potvin. She's Advocacy Coordinator at NAMI Wisconsin. We're looking at recent statistics from the CDC showing the prevalence of depression, often untreated depression, in the United States, and she shared some research and advice on that issue. After a fairly mellow December, it has gotten, if you hadn't noticed, cold here in Wisconsin. This week, most of the state is going to see days with high temperatures now, at or below zero. Today, over 30 school districts are closed because of cold weather.
And we'd love to know, how are you coping with this cold snap? Did you forget how after a mild start to the winter? Maybe there's an indoor activity, maybe a favorite food that gets you through the bitterly cold days. You can share your cold weather advice right now over on the Central Time Facebook page.
Or maybe you embrace the cold to try to get out and enjoy it somehow, or your work makes you go outside, whatever the weather. Tell us how you suit up to deal with the weather. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or go to the Central Time Facebook page. Well, you and I, we're out there. We're polar plunging.
We are.
We're riding the bike in the... No.
Wait. Maybe not the riding of bikes.
Well, no, definitely not me.
Although Wisconsinites are pretty hardy with their bike riding. I don't know. I feel like this cold weather, it's got to come sometime. It may as well come now. It
True.
Makes us worthy of the name Wisconsinite. I'm okay with it for now.
Yeah, we shouldn't complain too much. As like we said, it's been pretty mellow so far. I made some really good chicken soup this weekend and a good,
not as good
curried
as my
squash
chicken noodle soup.
Soup off right here this time tomorrow, man.
Bring it,
you
Rob.
And me.
Oh, sounds lovely. So we'll be
soup off.
We'll be eating that tomorrow.